Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we're going to talk with an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry about magnetic stimulation for depression. Dr. Susan Killenberg is going to be back on our show to talk with us about it.
Yeah, the issue of depression is such a prominent one among all of our patients, our families, and this is a new, recently approved Food and Drug Administration treatment for depression that probably most people don't know about. So I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. First, we've got some really interesting research that matters about tobacco deaths and about taking aspirin to prevent cancer.
About the Plan B study. That's not in comparison to Plan A, but we'll talk about that one for birth control.
And another study about statin drugs for cholesterol possibly having another benefit.
Pneumonia. Well, let's first start off talking about a recent report that's depressing and one, though, we need to talk about, which is the worldwide deaths that are occurring from tobacco in an annual report that came out just recently.
Yeah, I know that you are a major champion and a premier researcher in this area, Adam, so I'm sure you'll have a lot to say. But I mean, just thinking that one person every 6 seconds dies from tobacco use and exposure is shocking.
And a billion people will die between now and the end of the century unless we continue to find interventions. And while we have smoking rates declining still in the United States, it is still the number one leading cause of death for men and women. And in developing countries, over a third of deaths in many of these countries are due to tobacco. China alone, 1.2 million deaths a year. Now that will go up to 3.5 million within two decades.
Amazing. Astounding to think that the tobacco-related deaths have nearly tripled in the past decade. And the fact that that's largely that we're seeing the smoking rates in the developing world, the developed world, going down. So we think it's getting better. But in poorer regions of the world, it's going up.
Right. We sometimes forget that, 40 million Americans are addicted to nicotine, but worldwide over a billion. And the problems are that the tobacco industry, which is the vector, it's what's causing this mass uptake and continued use through the marketing practices. While there are changes that have been made in the United States, lots of these same changes are not being implemented overseas, and the warnings are not nearly as strong, and the legislation and the smoking in public places and advertising and the health effects in terms of the price of the product, they're not there like they are in the U.S. And so we think that the industry has changed, but a lot of it has not changed, and that's a travesty.
And it's so hard for me to grasp that this continues, that this product that is still so present in our world, if used as intended, kills people.
One word, Christy, money. $35 billion in profits in 2010 that this world's six biggest firms made. That's the combined earnings of Coca-Cola, Microsoft, and McDonald's. That's what sustains it. That's where we have to cut it off at its knees.
And the fact that they're targeting the people who don't have perhaps the education or understanding of how and targeting children and all of that is just disturbing.
Right. So we need to help our patients quit. We need to help children not to start. And we need to help the rest of the world and those people in those world do the exact same thing. So let's talk Christy, our very next study that goes from the population level down to an individual level. People with cancer, and would an aspirin help them with their cancer?
Do you take aspirin? Can I ask?
I do not take aspirin. Should I?
Well, maybe. I took it during pregnancy to reduce risk of preeclampsia. But other than that, I've never, you know, I don't take it regularly.
That's that pregnancy-induced high blood pressure.
Exactly. But this is another study showing there may be benefits of aspirin, not just for heart disease and not for just for some pregnancy-related conditions, but perhaps to prevent cancer or to keep cancer from spreading.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people up until at least a year ago were kind of uniform that men, you know, starting age 50, mm-hmm. you know, should be on an aspirin. And I decided not to because I had seen a number of people have bleeding complications from that aspirin. And so looking at my own lifestyle where I'm don't eat meat and I exercise a lot, I thought my risk was fairly low. But you could make an argument that perhaps I should. And that whole discussion about the heart benefits, now, however, maybe it's a little more complicated. Maybe I should rethink it based on this study about aspirin and cancer prevention.
Yeah. So this was in the new studies, they looked and found that aspirin may have short-term benefits in preventing cancer, may reduce the likelihood that cancers will spread to other organs, and that's that word metastasis, where the cancer spreads, by about 40 to 50%.
But you have to take the aspirin for 8 to 10 years before you might see the benefits. So that's the downside of it, but I think it is provocative. And these were three new studies that were in the Lancet and the Lancet Oncology journals. So I think this is going to be something we hear a lot more about.
Well, and we've known that there could be some benefit to preventing cancers in the gut that don't show for 8 to 10 years. Some of that has been out there that maybe we should be suggesting it for people at higher risk. But now they're saying that maybe that's because the aspirin is preventing some of that early spread and early growth. And it's really, really, I think, exciting. We have to be careful. And I want our listeners out there, this is not a message that everybody needs to be taking an aspirin because it can cause bleeding. But something to ask your doctor about.
And think carefully about and stay tuned. Speaking of staying tuned, this next research that matters, Christy, in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology is one that I know you treat a lot of young women and is an important one about this Plan B.
This was a study looking at girls younger than age 17 to determine if they can safely use the emergency contraception.
Morning after pill.
The morning after pill or Plan B without a prescription. So this was not looking at the ethical, social, political concerns about this, but just looking to see if young girls who read the labels and read the information could make a decision, an accurate decision about whether or not it was appropriate.
Yeah. Could they understand it and could they use it safely and effectively? And they studied 340 teenagers who did get a $10 incentive for participating in the study, and about 92% correctly used the criteria about whether they should use or not use the drug based on their answers.
Right. So this was about medical decision making, whether they fit those criteria or not. And in this study, they showed that the young girls could understand the directions and could make the decisions about whether or not that applied to their situation. And so that's the FDA has approved it for them. But there's still, of course, a lot of concerns, Adam, about whether or not this is appropriate on a different scale.
Well, and the Department of Health and Human Services overruled the Food and Drug Administration's decision, which is fairly unusual. That does not happen very often, which indicates that there are other considerations, I think primarily of a political nature, potentially in an election year. I will put that out there. But it's clear that these teenagers can use it and use it safely. We'll have to stay tuned and see what happens here.
Sure. Let's talk about the next study.
I think it probably should be. I mean, otherwise you have pregnancies that aren't wanted, but others may see that differently. But you're right. Let's talk about the last study.
The last one's about statin drugs. So, I mean, there's so much research coming out about these drugs for cholesterol. And this is another one showing that people who use these cholesterol-lowering statins may have a slightly lower risk of developing pneumonia than people who aren't taking them.
Yep. The Canadian Medical Association Journal published a study of 18,000 adults who were on Crestor, and there was a 17% lower risk of developing pneumonia, which is not a huge reduction, But if you were on a statin, maybe that's a good enough news for you to continue on it, assuming that you don't have any side effects. If you're not on it, I don't think I would use it just for the pneumonia reduction. But, you know, this is a little piece of good news.
Yeah. I mean, for almost 9,000 users followed for 5 years, it was 1.1% developed pneumonia that were taking the drug compared with 1.35% of the placebo users. So a small benefit, but, you know, another potential benefit.
Well, Christy, we've had a chance to discuss this, the statin drugs and this lower pneumonia risk.
About teens and prescription for Plan B.
That an aspirin a day and cancer prevention, staying tuned, it may be worthwhile considering, maybe.
And about worldwide smoking deaths tripling over a decade.
Time to intervene.
Yes.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Susan Killenberg about magnetic stimulation and depression. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Susan Killenberg, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UNC, about magnetic stimulation for depression.
Interesting topic. We want to welcome you, Dr. Killenberg, and thank you for joining us for the second time being on our show as a guest.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
You know, I don't know if the subject of depression is just so large, which it is, and it affects so many people, but we're actually going to talk today specifically about this magnetic stimulation for depression, or what's called TMS. And so maybe you can just say why it is that you're interested in this topic particularly, and what is TMS?
Yeah, well, as you said, depression is such a common illness and affects so many people and their quality of life. Then I became very excited when I learned that there was a new treatment for depression. The treatments that we have currently include psychotherapy and medications and ECT.
Which is
electroconvulsive therapy. It's a very old therapy, a very effective therapy for severe depression, but one with a lot of side effects. So it's really reserved for patients with quite severe depression. But transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Try to say that fast.
It's easier to say TMS. So I'll be referring to it as TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. Uses magnetic pulses that are applied to the scalp, the frontal part of the brain. There's a concave plate that just sits on the patient's scalp, kind of between the ear and the hairline, the beginning of the hairline, and creates magnetic pulses. And the patient will feel 4 seconds of pulsing, and then the machine rests for 26 seconds, and then another 4 seconds of pulsing. And that lasts, each treatment lasts for about 37 minutes.
And so it's what's happening inside?
So these magnetic pulses are able to penetrate through the skull and into the brain tissue. There's nothing actually sticking into the skull. It's just the magnetic field is penetrating. And when the magnetic field penetrates, it generates an electrical current in the tissue of the brain. And it's thought that this small electrical current that is getting stimulated in the brain stimulates the nerve cells of the brain and in that way treats depression over time. So similar to ECT, you're using electrical stimulation to treat the brain. However, unlike ECT, you're not inducing a seizure. So there's a lot of differences, yes.
So it's just small pulses of electricity into the brain to kind of try to wake up those nerve cells.
Exactly. And it's targeted at the left frontal area of the brain, which is thought to be underactive in depression. And then nerve pathways connect that part of the brain with deeper structures in the brain called the limbic system, and that center of the brain also gets activated with TMS. So it's thought that by activating these two essential areas in the brain that are that are underactive during depression, that you can treat the depression.
You know, I guess one of the first questions that I was thinking about when, and I think I had heard a little bit about this, but not a lot. Most of my colleagues don't really know much about this, is who would have thought of this? I mean, and why this particular type of therapy to think about, you know, is the first question. The second question is, well, what do we know about its effectiveness? Because, you know, I'm a little bit of a skeptic. I'm a late adopter of technology frequently, and this is technology, so I'm going to be one who needs to be convinced. So first off, say, how did people think about this, come up with it, and then what do we know about its effectiveness?
So how did people think of it? So the nerve cells in the brain are both chemical and electrical cells. So you can target these cells in the brain using chemicals like antidepressant medications, and that changes the chemical balance in the brain and treats depression from a chemical standpoint. The problem with that treatment of depression is it doesn't always work for people, and these chemicals are entering your body systemically, so you can get other side effects. You can have change in appetite, change in weight, change in sleep patterns, change in sexual drive with these medications. So the other way you can treat the nerve cells of the brain is with the electrical stimulation, and that's what we know is happening with ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. The patient is put under anesthesia, and a seizure is generated in the brain, and that increased electrical activity of the seizure treats the depression. So for the past 20 years, people have been experimenting with this TMS concept of trying to produce electrical stimulation of the brain, but in a way that's much more easy and better tolerated than ECT. And that's what they've done with TMS. So it's been used experimentally for about 20 years and FDA approved now since 2008.
Food and Drug Administration approved. Tell us about what we know then about, even though it's approved, what type of impact it has, because again, I think it's relatively new, and do we have complete science enough to say that it works? Because FDA can approve things that sometimes later they disapprove.
Right.
Do we really have enough data on that it works?
Yeah. So they did test TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, in what are called placebo-controlled trials, where half the patients in the group are getting the active TMS treatment and the other half are getting a placebo treatment. And they actually were able to
stimulate the other area of the brain.
No, they put a plate on the head that created a tapping sensation, but without having it give magnetic pulses. So they were creating a tapping sensation against the scalp,
so
exactly,
they felt like they were getting
but
it.
not stimulating the brain. And they did show that the TMS patients did much better than the placebo patients, the patients who weren't getting the active TMS.
Meaning they improved
their depression symptoms. Symptoms tended to improve. And then the other kind of studies that have looked at the use of transcranial magnetic stimulation are called open label studies, where everyone's getting the active TMS treatment. They all know they're getting the treatment. And in those studies, about 50% of people will say that their symptoms are better, not completely gone, but significantly better. And about a third of the patients will say that their depression really goes into remission, which are pretty good numbers when you compare it to psychiatric medicine.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thinking of psychiatric medicine, we know that some of those medicines have side effects. And just intuitively, you would think putting electricity in someone's brain might have some downsides or dangers. What do we know about the risks?
So the most common side effects are a feeling of discomfort or headache where the magnet is placed against the scalp. So patients will feel the tapping sensation. And at first, especially in the beginning treatment, the treatment, we haven't discussed this yet, but takes place over a four-week period. Usually during the first week, patients will notice scalp discomfort. They might have a headache for an hour or two after the treatment. However, they are able to drive themselves home or drive themselves to work and go on with their workday immediately after treatment. We don't know of any long-term side effect from the magnetic and electrical stimulation from TMS. As I said, it's been used experimentally now for 20 years, and there aren't known to be long-term side effects.
What do we know about the studies? Because one or two that I looked at were relatively short-term studies. They were effective, mm-hmm. but they were studies where they were treated for 4 weeks. We have, as clinicians, Christy and I treat dozens of patients a year with depression with drugs that they've been on, in many cases, for years if they're working. What do we know about the longer-term treatment of this, or do we need more research?
Yeah, we do need more research. The research that has come out has looked at a six-month period following the active four-week phase of TMS. And what they found is once the TMS was finished, those people in these studies were put on an antidepressant medication to try to maintain the gains that they had made from the transcranial magnetic stimulation. In 6 months' time, a third of those patients had roughening of symptoms, so their depressive symptoms started to come back again. In this study design, they were allowed to restart TMS if they had this roughening of symptoms, and 80% of those went back to feeling well again. So overall, about 10% of people in 6 months had relapsed completely.
Well, we want to hear a little bit more about those studies, about side effects, about cost. We have so much to talk about.
How does it work?
Yeah. But we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Susan Killenberg, about magnetic stimulation for depression. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Susan Killenberg, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UNC, about magnetic stimulation for depression. And we were just having a conversation, Dr. Killenberg, about some of the ways that it's been studied trying to think about which patients do we know that it really makes a difference for. So from your perspective, which patients are the best patients for this type of treatment?
So the patients we're tending to see in clinical practice are patients that have tried multiple antidepressant medications by the time they come to consider transcranial magnetic stimulation for their depression. Typically, if a patient has depression, they might try one medication. If they don't do well, try a second or third medication. Sometimes two or three combinations of medicines are tried together to treat their depression. But we tend to see people who either haven't done well with those medicines, or the medicine stops working over time, or they just have intolerable side effects to the medicine.
So is this like with ECT or the electric convulsant therapy that where you induce the seizures? I've seen that used in severely, severely, like profoundly depressed patients where everything else hasn't worked, and seeing that it can work. Is this sort of in the same category where it's reserved for those really, really profoundly depressed people?
It doesn't have to be, but currently it tends to be, just because I think it's so much easier to just try antidepressant medications first compared to coming into the office every day for a 4 to 6 week period to have the TMS treatment. So we tend to see people who are more treatment resistant, who have tried multiple strategies and really want to try something very different to treat their depression.
You know, I had a patient just recently who has depression, who has tried multiple medicines and doesn't want to use medicines anymore because of the side effects mm-hmm. that you discussed and we know. And they were open to trying TMS or magnetic stimulation. And the first question was, well, will my insurance company pay for it? And so let's talk a little bit about, even though it's approved by the FDA, what does that really mean in terms of insurance companies paying for it or not paying for it? And how much does it cost?
Right. Unfortunately, currently in North Carolina, the insurance companies are not paying for TMS, and it does tend to be very expensive.
Like, what does that mean by
so over the 4 to 6 weeks, it could be between $5,000 to $8,000. We are having our patients submit the bills to the insurance companies, and we're working with them through the appeals process to try to get coverage, because we do feel it's an important tool in the treatment of depression and feel strongly.
Let me just stop one second. If over 4 weeks they would come in once a week for the treatment?
Once a day, 5 days a week.
5 days a week. So that's 20 treatments.
20 to 25 treatments.
It would be $5,000 to $10,000 or
correct.
Something like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're working with patients to try to get approval through insurance companies. There are companies in different states around the U.S. that are now approving TMS with a prior authorization. If the patient meets certain criteria, their insurance company will pay for the TMS. So I think it's just a matter of time before North Carolina will start paying as well for the TMS.
Well, let's ask the question from an insurance company perspective. Why shouldn't they cover it if it's effective? What's the argument for not covering it? And then, well, if it's effective, maybe despite its initial upfront cost, maybe it's potentially cost effective down the line.
Mm-hmm. They aren't paying for medications or hospitalizations.
So why are insurance companies scared? Is it because there's only one brand on the market and they have the entire market?
I'm not sure. The reasons that we tend to get in the rejection letters when we've applied for benefit coverage is that they are calling TMS investigational. We have argued back to them with data from multiple studies saying that it's no longer investigational. And as you mentioned, the FDA has approved its use for the treatment of major depression. Or they might argue that it doesn't meet medical necessity, that alternative treatments should be tried instead. But as I mentioned, many of the patients that come to us have tried numerous alternative treatments. And so we try to make that point to the insurance company as well.
I know you have a lot of experience helping women with postpartum depression and anxiety. And it seems that for patients who don't want to take medications or concerned about breastfeeding, that they may be interested in this. And I understand you're thinking of studying that. I would be concerned. I need some information from you about how to counsel them well for any potential unknown risk. But tell us a little bit about what you're investigating for that population.
Yeah, I became interested initially in transcranial magnetic stimulation because I do treat women in pregnancy and postpartum, and I hear from them on a regular basis that they have worries about taking medication, antidepressant medication during pregnancy or postpartum while they're breastfeeding the baby. So I became very interested in an alternative non-medication treatment for depression. There's only one group that has studied the use of TMS during pregnancy, and they conducted that in an obstetrical suite with fetal monitoring. So that really isn't ready to be rolled out in a mm-hmm. general population. However, postpartum, the TMS does not interfere with lactation, so it really does achieve the goal of the woman being able to have her depression treated without using medication. Mm-hmm. And I am recruiting for a study here at UNC that would provide free TMS treatment for women with postpartum depression.
Not men.
No, they can actually not be on a medication while they're receiving the TMS.
They can't be men.
They can't be men.
So in North Carolina, to receive this treatment, you have to enter a study to be one of the people, or you have to have
money out of pocket, unfortunately, at the current time. I hope that within a year or two that will change.
Well, it sounds like there is certainly sufficient interest from the consumer community, from the provider community. And usually when you have those two things, and the medical device, you know, approved. And let's just jump forward for a second. If this is working and does work for depression, I'm sure there are patient advocacy groups and providers alike who are saying, well, would it work for Alzheimer's disease? Would it work for people with other, like bipolar disease? What about people with other mood disorders? Is this an explosion that we're going to see in terms of people who have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, who maybe just need a little electrical stimulation? Is that the case or not?
Yeah, there is a lot of exciting research going on about other uses of TMS. They include use for post-stroke recovery, use for Parkinson's disease, use for chronic pain. In fact, we learned from the TMS representative that they're using it for phantom limb pain for soldiers who have had amputations after they've served in combat. Other uses for anxiety and bipolar disorder are being investigated, but there's no standardized protocol at this point for treating those disorders, so they're not commonly used in clinical practice. But again, I agree that within a few years' time, there will be multiple different uses for TMS.
So for our listeners out there who, I mean, there's so many people suffering with depression looking for that other alternative option, where can people get more information either about your study or about TMS itself?
So the website to learn about TMS itself would be www.neurostartms.com, and that will explain all about the TMS machine and procedures and how it works, and with references to some of the studies. If people were interested in exploring TMS at UNC, that would be through the UNC faculty practice at Connor Drive. The phone number for that is 929-7449. And then if they were interested in the study for postpartum depression, that could be a link to that study could be found at the Women's Mood Disorders website at UNC.
And that mood disorders website, if you just Google
UNC Women's Mood Disorders.
Yes, then you
correct.
I guess I just one final question is, I'm thinking about this, and I guess I am struck by the cost. Why is it so expensive? It doesn't sound like this is all that complicated. Is it the time of the provider? Is the upfront cost of the equipment, the investment that has to be recouped? And if those two things are there, can this be eventually made something that people could almost do at home with the advancement of technology? Where do you see the field heading? Because it seems like that ultimately is going to be the driver of whether this is accepted more broadly.
Yeah, the current machine is quite costly, and there's a specialized treatment link that links the machine to the computer system that runs the machine, and that's quite costly. And then the doctor who's providing the treatment, who's in the room with you each hour as you have the treatment over that 4 to 6 week period. So those costs add up.
So, well, we're going to have to pay attention to this as it moves along, and we appreciate, Dr. Killenberg, your willingness to come in here and be on the kind of the cutting edge of science and applied research here. We're glad to see UNC is involved with this, and we should also note that you're our first guest who's been on our show twice, and we really appreciate you sharing your expertise with your health listeners.
Oh, that's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Killenberg.
Well, coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
Yeah, Christy, we have a question about Morton's neuroma. That's a mouthful, but an important problem. And also a question about sciatica.
And a question about TMJ, or jaw pain, and about vitamin D.
Well, let's just dive right in and listen to our very first House Call question about someone who's concerned they might have this Morton's neuroma.
I was told by my doctor that I might have Morton's neuroma on the bottom of my foot. It's painful. He wanted to refer me to a podiatrist, but a friend told me to try orthotics. What are they, and do they work?
Well, Christy, I assume this is Morton's neuroma was come about from Dr. Morton. That's why it's probably called Morton's neuroma.
Well, I can touch on what are orthotics, and you can chime in a little bit more. But orthotics are these inserts that you can put in your shoe that form to support your foot in the right way. They can be over the counter that you can get at some like shoe stores and sports stores.
Rite Aid, CVS, Walgreens.
Yeah. Or they can be custom made for your foot that a lot of podiatrists will refer people to do, but that's very expensive.
And it's important that you, when you have an orthotic, that you know what the problem is on the foot. So if you have a problem with your heel, you frequently get a heel lift. It takes some pressure off the heel by elevating that area so it doesn't have so much pressure when you step on. In this case, the Morton's neuroma is an impingement on the nerve, and it's right as the nerve goes in between the toe webs of the feet frequently, and the third or second or fourth toe web of the foot is frequently where that kind of gets pinched. It could happen from someone who's done a running or a long marathon, or just happens where that tissue gets a little scarred and it starts pushing on that nerve, and then they get pain there, and then what you have to do is take pressure off the nerve.
Let's take our next House Call question.
I've been diagnosed with sciatica. I can run, jump, and ride a bike for extended periods of time, but if I sit in a vehicle for more than an hour, I get a shooting pain down the backs of my legs. What can I do besides taking frequent breaks to break this cycle? I take weekly road trips for my job and can't always avoid long car trips.
Oh, back pain. I have to say, Adam, I haven't told you the story, but I fell off a hammock recently. It came off the side of the, out of the tree, and I fell on my back. And from that—
How did that happen, Christy?
Don't even start. but I am so much more—
You got low back pain after?
Oh, my goodness. Terrible pain. And you know, hearing your story, I am so much more sympathetic to what it is to really, really have low back pain that radiates, like what you're talking about, than I was before. It really hurts, and it can be scary.
We're sorry, Christy, that you have that.
Well, I'm sorry for our listener is what I was trying to say, that I'm so much more sorry than I used to be about.
Well, in this particular case, what is called sciatica, there is a sciatic nerve that comes down the buttocks and goes down the back of the leg, and that can cause a lot of pain. But a lot of times people call something sciatica that sometimes it may or may not be actually the inflammation of that nerve, because lots of things can cause pain that goes down one or both legs. So first thing I would really want to know is hope that you how the diagnosis was made, and maybe seeing a really good physical therapist to make sure that's what it is.
The fact that you can run and jump and ride a bike and do those things is very encouraging, that it's not anything more serious. But if it's sciatica or if it's a tight muscle, it can be very bothersome.
Well, and sometimes people who sit in a car and get tight muscles, that actually isn't sciatica, but it's a tight psoas muscle, P-S-O-A-S, psoas muscle, and you get psoas syndrome. And the exercises you need to do to stretch that particular muscle are not the same ones you use for sciatica. So you might really need to see a physical therapist here to come up with some specific exercises to see if it gets better.
So the answer could be in anti-inflammatory medications and seeing a physical therapist and certain water therapies.
And stretching every hour rather than taking when you're driving.
Yep. Okay, let's take our next one.
A friend of mine was recently diagnosed with TMJ. What is TMJ and can it really cause hearing loss?
TMJ is the temporomandibular joint, which is that joint when you open and close your mouth. If you feel the space on your jaw right in front of your ears, you can kind of feel it moving.
You can dig your finger right into that. And what we'll frequently do is feel that joint, and if people have clicking in their jaw or they have pain in that particular area, you might have inflammation or TMJ.
And people give bite guards. You can get your dentist to make a guard to help you when you're sleeping at night. And there, people sometimes take anti-inflammatories for this as well. Your question about can it cause hearing loss?
I hadn't seen that, Christy.
Me either.
Hadn't seen that. You know, it can cause lots of things: earaches and
headaches.
Ringing in the ear and headaches. Right? Yeah. But if it's truly hearing loss you're experiencing, it may well be worthwhile to see an ear, nose, and throat specialist. Make sure that that's diagnosed appropriately. TMJ, lots of ways to treat it. One is just don't chew so much. If you like, sometimes people chew lots of gum or chewing ice, and that can cause inflammation. So good luck with your this problem, and we know it's concerning.
Let's take our next house call question about vitamin D.
I have some friends whose doctors seem very concerned about their vitamin D levels. I also have friends who say when they've asked their doctors about it, they say it really isn't that important. What does vitamin D do, and what is going on here with different doctors?
I don't know what you think, Christy, but sometimes I think the doctors are more concerned about vitamin D today than the patients. I don't know.
Well, it is sort of it's the vitamin that's in vogue right now. And there are more and more studies with these possible associations and benefits of having of either having normal vitamin D levels or of taking vitamin D supplementation. There are also lots of studies coming out about most children and people being deficient in vitamin D, which is important for you to help absorb calcium, to have strong bones. There may be parts of your immune system and other benefits to having good vitamin D levels.
And I'll disclose that when I had my physical and I had a vitamin D level checked by the recommendation of my doctor, mine was borderline low, and I drank no milk products whatsoever. And so rather than take the vitamin D supplement, which I got kind of tired of doing, I started just having milk two or three times a week with my morning breakfast with cereal. So
mine
there
is
are
low
ways
too,
of,
and it's a pain to take those vitamin D pills. It's hard to keep up with.
Yeah, I remember. Hard to do that. So this is a good question. It's one that I don't know if our answer does real justification, because it's a lot of things going on here, and you need a longer conversation with your primary care provider.
And the truth is, doctors don't totally know. The research is still not out to say that treating it and reaching some target level is necessarily going to benefit your health.
So we'll put some information about what vitamin D does. We'll ask our resource librarians to help us put this up on our website. And I think what's going on with different doctors is this is evolving. And so probably both or multiple doctors are right on this, but you need to have that conversation. So thanks for your question, and thanks for all of the questions here today. We hope we've been able to address some issues that are important to you.
And we want you to share your questions. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes.
Free podcast or the show. Available, and we'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Susan Killenberg.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health, and on behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.